Really, the evidence shows us that the biggest improvement that people experience when they're successfully housed is regarding their health outcomes. You know, if you're receiving services while in a supportive housing situation, people are able to focus on themselves.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and you're listening to Into the Fold, Issues in Mental Health. The Hogg Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Without a safe, stable, and affordable place to live, it is extremely difficult to achieve a high level of mental health and well-being. Meaningful housing options for people experiencing mental illness and substance use conditions are extremely limited because housing must not only be affordable, but paired with the supports and services needed to achieve recovery. When there is a lack of affordable, supportive housing in the community, people experiencing mental illness and substance use conditions often end up homeless, hospitalized, or incarcerated. In episode 51, Jason Howell of Recovery People, a recipient of a Hogg Foundation Peer Policy Fellows grant, told us why housing is so critical.
Recovery housing has been such a vital part of my recovery and things I do, so I'm very passionate around it. I mean, everybody needs housing, and for individuals that are on an absence pathway to recovery, you know, how do we get them into an environment that supports that pathway, and really, where do they learn to live recovery? And that's recovery housing or recovery residences.
We're now in the middle of the 86th Texas legislative session, and with the redesign of our state hospitals now high on the agenda, there are now opportunities for far-reaching change in our mental health system, and this includes housing. Our guest today is Tanya Lavelle, policy specialist for the Hogg Foundation. She's logged many hours at the Capitol and is an expert on mental health and housing. Tanya, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Ike.
In my intro, I used the term meaningful housing options for people experiencing mental health and substance use conditions. Can you summarize what those might be and how they operate?
Thanks so much for having me. First of all, Ike, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about mental health and housing. It's a very important issue, not only to me personally, but to really the wellness of people experiencing mental illness in their communities. So when we say meaningful housing options, traditionally you think about housing and you just think about, you know, an apartment in, you know, a standard housing complex, and it's just something that is just kind of a roof over somebody's head. But for people experiencing mental illness, it really is more than that. To support somebody's recovery and to ensure that they are achieving the highest level of wellness that they can, it's important to make sure that they're not just in, you know, an apartment per se, but they're paired with services. And for somebody that may be, you know, more intensive services, it might be going to, you know, counseling, it might be going to meetings, peer supports, things like that, or it could be something kind of a lower degree of involvement. And when we say meaningful, really the housing has to be meaningful to the person. So not just, it's allowing them really to choose the level of support that they need as well as the housing that they want, whether that be, you know, living with a roommate or a apartment in a traditional setting, or it could be even an apartment, you know, really associated with something like a homeless shelter or a supportive housing provider, in which that they are surrounded by other people kind of going through the same experiences that they are, and they're able to find more support in that.
It's probably intuitive to a lot of people that there is a strong correlation between housing stability and mental health. But what does the evidence tell us about the actual strength of the correlation?
So without a real safe, stable, affordable place to live, it is very difficult for somebody to achieve recovery. If people experiencing mental illness do not have an affordable, safe, stable place to live, they often end up either homeless, incarcerated, or they will end up receiving services in more of a hospital kind of crisis setting. Really, the evidence shows us that the biggest improvement that people experience when they're successfully housed is regarding their health outcomes. You know, if you're receiving services while in a supportive housing situation, people are able to focus on themselves. They can focus more on their recovery. They can focus on becoming well, and they don't have to worry about whether or not they have a roof over their head. And as you can imagine, it's very difficult to be able to focus on yourself if you're worried about where you're going to sleep at night. If you're worried about if you're going to be safe, if you're worried about, you know, we had a cold snap in Austin about 2 weeks ago. I can't imagine what it must have been like for somebody in kind of a homeless situation trying to figure out where they were going to sleep without being so cold at night. And so if you're connected with supportive housing options, then you really can focus on achieving recovery and not so much kind of achieving survival, if you will.
Lack of available beds is often used as a shorthand for our mental health system's lack of capacity. This phrasing highlights the emphasis that's put on inpatient settings within the mental health system. So, how regularly do you have to remind people that community-based housing options are one of the tools that we have to support the mental health system?
It's just like you said, Ike, the lack of available beds is definitely the term people jump to most frequently when they're talking about capacity. It's kind of the most concrete way to measure whether or not services exist in the community, unfortunately, because you can look at a hospital, you say, this is how many beds, you know, this is how many slots we have to give people services, without really regarding whether or not that's the best place for people to be. And so this absolutely does highlight the need for affordable housing in community. And oftentimes people don't think about that as an option. One of my biggest hurdles at the Capitol, you know, even speaking with folks at agencies, is really helping them understand that unless you create a system of housing options in the community, people are simply going to cycle through hospital systems. They're going to cycle in and out of homelessness because we can provide services in hospital settings. But we don't necessarily think about how we're going to help people on the way out. Ideally, you treat somebody in an inpatient setting and you give them a plan after they leave. But that doesn't happen often. And even if it does, if we help people, you know, figure out how to find housing, it's going to be a game changer because they won't need to receive services in the same crisis setting. They'll be able to, you know, offer that space up to people who need more intensive services. And really allow people to become more successful in their communities. And I think something really that is worth mentioning is that housing problems are not specific to people experiencing mental illness. There's a huge need across the state, really across all income brackets, for affordable housing in Texas. And Texas specifically, you know, the population is booming, the economy is growing. And in Texas, we're about over 95% occupied in terms of rental opportunities, which being in Austin, I'm sure everyone can attest to. It's very difficult to find an apartment here, whether or not you're income limited. And so people experiencing mental illness often fall into what we call the extremely low income bracket, which is somebody who makes 30% or below of area median income. And people who are experiencing mental illness often, really their only source of income is disability. And that is not nearly enough to afford a market apartment. And so in Texas, there's only 30 available extremely low income units for every 100 people who need them. So there's a huge gap there. And then you're also talking about people who are extremely low income. About 70% of them are considered to be cost burdened. And that's people who have to pay more than 30% of their income to housing. And, you know, somebody I visited with who was somebody experiencing mental illness who was trying to achieve recovery through housing, with his Social Security disability payments, if he used that toward a regular market apartment, he was only going to have $25 left a month to cover everything else.
Wow.
And so that's a big gap. And so Texas needs to really look at this holistically. But obviously people experiencing mental illness have another challenge in that they need supportive services along with affordable housing, and the options there are extremely limited.
What is the evidence for the effectiveness of supported housing, and is there a way to estimate how much money would be saved over the long term by investing in it?
Yeah, so this can be hard to track just because, at least in terms of cost effectiveness, supportive housing programs look very different across the state, and the cost savings look a lot different across the state too, just based on how much it costs to receive services, how much it costs to find an apartment. You know, it's going to cost a lot more to live in Austin than it will to live in Amarillo. And so that kind of being able to track costs that way can be a little difficult. But evidence does show that it costs between $30,000 and $50,000 a year for somebody to remain chronically homeless. And people who are chronically homeless, I think about in the recent Austin point in time count, actually the Texas point in time count, found that about 17% of people identified as having a mental health condition. And those are only people who self-identified. And so it's expected that that number is higher. And so if you're looking at assigning a cost to that, you're talking about that many homeless folks who are costing, you know, between $30,000 and $50,000 a year. That's a big cost. And then it costs about $675 a day for somebody to receive inpatient services in Texas. And so that's a huge cost. And supportive housing services generally cost a lot less than that. And then in terms of kind of the evidence for effectiveness, a lot of that can be seen in the health outcomes. So with supportive housing, there is a good indicator of reduction in hospitalizations. There's a reduction in crisis services. And obviously, there's a reduction in homelessness. They have to be involved to some degree. A lot of supportive housing services require that they are involved with local mental health authorities, with case management. And so these programs are setting people up to be successful. They're setting them up to be stably housed, not just throwing them in an apartment and hoping for the best. And that's why these programs are so successful. It's because we're really helping people to plan for their futures. We're helping them to become successfully housed so they can help themselves moving forward and they won't need as many services in the future.
Do you have real life examples? You did mention an acquaintance of yours. Of the difference that alternative approaches like supported housing can make in people's lives.
Yeah, so when I actually started out as a HOG policy fellow with Easter Seals. And so one of the opportunities I had was to study supportive housing across the state. That's what I chose to do as my research project for my second year. And part of that was traveling across the state and actually meeting people who had firsthand experience in what it was like to both be homeless and then what their lives looked like after they were able to become successfully housed. And the gentleman I spoke of earlier, who had the big income gap with his SSI and his Austin Market apartment, he actually was a gentleman who struggled with substance abuse. And because of that, he was evicted from multiple apartments just because of kind of his struggles with becoming sober. And so he was on disability and he could not afford an apartment on his own. And so he was able to be connected with the local mental health authority through Front Steps, which is a nonprofit in Austin that works with the homelessness population to help them secure services. And he was able to receive case management. He had a variety of services available to him through his local mental health authority, and they were able to secure him a housing voucher, which actually helped him to achieve sobriety. And when I spoke to him, this was probably 5 or 6 years ago, he showed me his 18-month sobriety chip, and he was very proud, and he could not have stressed more how much housing made a difference to him. And then another gentleman I like to think about a lot, he really motivated me in my work, and he kind of heartens me at how important housing is. He was from Harlingen, and he actually was somebody who had been working for his entire adult life, and he struggled with blindness, and it came on very quickly. And so within a 2-week time span, he went from being a manager in a restaurant to being homeless. And he was able to actually connect through his local mental health authority to get services. And they helped him receive housing through the Supportive Housing Rental Assistance Program. And so they're able to give him 6 months of services, 6 months of housing assistance paired with services. And they were able to sustain that long enough for him to get a permanent housing voucher. And after that, things fell into place for him. And I love to refer back to some of the quotes that he gave me. But my favorite was, he said, "It makes all the difference in the world if you have a home to go to. If you have a place to hang your hat and be secure in the knowledge that you're not going to be sleeping in the alley under a tarp and have to go hungry, you can get yourself together from that point." And I think that's one of the most meaningful things I've ever heard from somebody who is, you know, a person in recovery. He actually ended up going on to be a peer support specialist And that's something I saw with a lot of the folks I interviewed, is that they received the services, they saw how their own lives improved, and they really wanted to share that with people. And I think that's something that is not often thought of when we're talking about, you know, supportive housing, when we're talking about housing in general, is that when people's lives improve, part of that is they want to help their communities. They want to help their peers also achieve recovery.
Yeah. A phrase we like to use here is social determinants of mental health. I think that that often translates to the concrete and tangible elements of recovery. And housing, I would think, is a prime example.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
How optimistic are you that there might be major movement on this issue during session? And what legislative developments do you think people should be tracking?
So generally speaking, housing is a difficult topic. It's difficult to understand, and it is funded kind of differently. A lot of housing programs in Texas and nationally are federally funded. So they come with a lot of rules and regulations already put into place. So there's not a ton that a lot of states can do if they just look at the programs that are funded through federal dollars. And so one of the things that advocates often suggest to legislators, to agencies, is to invest general revenue dollars in housing, because that allows the state to create their own plans. Really, we can create, you know, a Texas housing program and address the needs of Texans individually once we invest general revenue into them. And so one of the things that I was heartened at this session is that there's been some movement around the Supportive Housing Rental Assistance Program, which I mentioned briefly earlier. And so with the renewed interest of the legislature around mental health, this has been the last session or two, a lot of folks have been interested in investing in mental health services. And this session in particular, it really seems to have fallen into looking at mental health services around schools and school-aged children, including, you know, foster youth. But over the interim, which is what we call the interim, is the years between sessions, legislators continue to work through committees. And so they will meet as a committee. They will, whether it's the Senate or the House, they'll get interim charges from either the Speaker of the House or the Lieutenant Governor, which are directives of things that they should be studying over the interim to help them make, you know, educated decisions in the upcoming session. And so this past interim session, the Public Health Committee in the House examined mental health, and they examined specifically mental health services and housing. And there was a committee hearing that was joint between the Public Health Committee and the Urban Affairs Committee, which is traditionally the committee that deals with housing services. And they really broke down the options available to people experiencing mental illness, the homeless housing options, things that really pair housing with support services. And what they settled on was one of their recommendations was to improve housing services that run through local mental health authorities, because there is a proven package of services available through local mental health authorities, and they're already connected with the vulnerable populations that these housing programs are meant to serve. And one of those programs is called the Supportive Housing Rental Assistance Program. And it's a really unique program. It provides short and long-term housing assistance to people experiencing mental illness who are receiving services through their local mental health authorities. And there's a lot of flexibility in the program for LMHAs to really help their clients in the ways that they think would be most appropriate for them. It's really a person-centered program. You know, earlier when we were discussing meaningful housing options, this is really one way to make it meaningful for folks, because they are able to help direct their own services with their case manager, and they're also able to help kind of direct where they think the funding needs to go. And so local mental health authorities are able to use this money in really creative ways. For example, there was a local mental health authority I spoke with in North Texas who was able to provide just a small amount of money to help a client put down a deposit on an apartment, because if she was unable to, she was going to have to either become homeless or move in with family who were not going to be supportive of her recovery. And this sort of illustrates one of the more unique things about this program, in that it supports people who are not currently homeless but facing homelessness. And that's really unique, because we're really, you know, kind of addressing the issue before it becomes a major problem. And oftentimes that requires a very small investment. And so really the average cost of helping people through this program is just, it's a little bit above $2,300 total. And that's huge. Like I mentioned earlier, you know, it's over $650 a night to be hospitalized in an inpatient setting. We're looking at $30,000 to $50,000 a year for somebody who's chronically homeless. And this program requires $2,300 per client for people to remain successfully housed. And one of the biggest kind of challenges that we see at a statewide level is a lack of housing vouchers. And that's something a lot of people think about when they're thinking about, you know, housing for people with disabilities, more traditional housing for people with disabilities, is that there are federal programs available specifically for people experiencing mental illness, people experiencing physical or intellectual disabilities to help them become successfully housed. And they are rent-supported housing vouchers, and they can be run through kind of the federal level. They can be run by counties, local housing authorities. There's a variety of programs available, but because there is such a high need for this housing, you're looking at 3 to 5 year waiting lists for a lot of these vouchers. And so another unique component of the Supportive Housing Rental Assistance Program is that because there are very kind of few limitations on how the money can be spent, you can really use it in a way to kind of support somebody long term until a voucher becomes available. And so one of the local mental health authorities in Central Texas told me that they were able to provide assistance to one of their clients who was a grandmother and had grandkids. And she, you know, over the course of a couple of years would sometimes come up against, you know, she needed a little bit of help to make ends meet that month. And they never fully supported her rent, but they were able to give her little bits over the course of a couple of years until a voucher opened up. And so that was another way that they kept somebody who wasn't currently homeless from becoming homeless. And one of the things that I was excited about this session is that there were some legislative offices that were interested in expanding this program. HHSC, which is the agency that pairs or that works with the local mental health authorities to operate this program, has interest in expanding it because they're seeing the value, not just because of the cost savings, but because we're really helping people, you know, achieve recovery. And, you know, these are also folks who are actively planning for their future. They're planning on how they're going to become financially stable once the funding runs out. And so even though it's a short-term assistance program, it really is helping people kind of plan for their futures and to become successful after the fact. And so one of the things that happened at the legislature this session was Representative Wally from the Houston area actually wrote up a rider that the state increased general revenue enough to expand the program statewide. Currently, it only operates at 20 of the local mental health authorities, and the funding he requested would expand it to all 39 local mental health and local behavioral health authorities.
Okay. And thank you for that.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, your capacious mind is why we asked you to be on.
Oh, goodness. That's a flattering comment. I appreciate it.
So are there good resources for non-experts who want to become more informed on this issue?
Absolutely. So one of the organizations I like to speak about is the Corporation for Supportive Housing. They're actually a HAWG grantee. They have a policy fellow right now. And they're a great organization. They follow supportive housing issues, not just in Texas, but nationally. And so they're a great resource kind of not just for Texas-specific information, but also kind of national trends and what's going on at the federal level, which is important since, as I mentioned, a lot of these housing options are federally funded. And the federal government has a lot to do with how housing is provided in the states. There's another organization I like to refer folks to. It's the National Low Income Housing Coalition, and they're another national organization that has a Texas presence. The Texas chapter, if you will, is called the Texas Housers, and they look a lot at supportive housing. They look at low income housing. They study fair housing issues, which is obviously a problem for people experiencing mental illness because they can often face stigma, and you know, that can sometimes play out in tense landlord situations. Even just not having housing is a fair housing issue. And so that is a great organization that studies more of kind of like the social impact of housing that I like to talk about.
Okay. So this episode is the third of our special series on mental health and policy. Don't miss our recent episode 74, A Chance to Do Better for First Episode Psychosis, and episode 75, Substance Use, A Public Health Approach. Both of these are about promising public health approaches to other challenging aspects of mental health in Texas, and we hope that you check them out. Tanya, adding another important piece of the puzzle, housing. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your knowledge and wisdom with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Ike. I appreciate it.
And speaking of policy and the legislative session, be sure to check out the latest edition of A Guide to Understanding Mental Health Systems and Services in Texas, our one-of-a-kind comprehensive guide to the Texas mental health system, intended for policymakers, state agency staff, and mental health consumers and their families. It's available on our website at hogg.utexas.edu. And I have provided a link to the guide in the description for this episode. Thanks for joining us.